Hi, Radicals, and thanks for tuning in. This is Sam here from the Radical Writing Podcast. Some of these texts stretch content as experimentally as they do form, and this is a heads up that some episodes feature discussions of a particularly sensitive nature. For example, we may be reading and then elaborating on extracts which feature swearing, violence, and sexual content. And discussions will be compassionate and empathetic, but also, in order to accurately reflect the text, explicit. Engaging with these challenging topics is often key to the author's technique and central to the story they're telling. But they can be difficult subjects to discuss and listen to. Listen for the trigger warnings at the start of the episode, and if you prefer to avoid that episode, do check out another one from the series. And if you think that the series as a whole may not be suitable for you, that's okay too. If you are comfortable listening on, now is the time to pop your headphones on or to find a private space. Hello, Radicals, and welcome to the weird and wonderful literary world of the Radical Writing Podcast, the series dedicated to the best in contemporary experimental or innovative writing. This is episode 6, Maggie Nelson's Bluets. My name is Sam Kemp, and I'll be your host. I'm a poet and lecturer in creative writing. Today, my guests are Deborah Walker and Diwale Demerji, and we've all chosen a favourite section of the book and prepared some questions for one another. There are some trigger warnings associated with Maggie Nelson's Bluets. There are some explicit sexual references, discussions of mental health and illness as well. Bluets is a genre-defying lyric essay by Maggie Nelson. It consists of a series of 240 numbered fragments, ranging from as short as a single sentence to a whole page, and it touches on themes of desire, depression, heartache, and God. Its main interest is in searching for the cultural, artistic, and synesthetic qualities of the color blue, but it does so through lucid and elegant reflections on sex and love. Its prose poetry form has made it an iconic text which has shaped the modern lyric essay genre. And it was first published in the UK in 2017 by Jonathan Cape, and it's this beautiful hardback edition which we're using today. And we're being extra radical today on the Radical Writing Podcast, and something of a first in that we've got our guest Deborah Walker, who is zooming in to us. Deborah, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for asking me. My name's Deborah Walker. I'm a writer and a professor of creative writing here at Northeastern.
And Diwale.
Thank you, Sam. I'm Diwale Demerji. I'm actually an academic administrator academic advisor. And closetly, I am a writer, really. They don't know yet. They'll find out once it's all broadcast. That's it.
You're a secret poet, Diwale.
I'm a writer first, but poetry is one of those facets in which you can express your writing and it's more succinct. Yeah.
So thank you both of you so much for coming on, Deborah and Diwale. And Deborah, this is a text that you recommended, and I'm so, so glad that you did. I wanted to kind of break with tradition of the podcast. We'll kind of go into favorite quotes in a little bit. But I actually wanted to read the first fragment section. I'm not sure quite what we would call these 240 paragraphs. Because I thought it was such a lovely introduction to the project. So if anyone is kind of wondering, well, what is a lyric essay and what is the project that's going on here? I think number one begins to answer that. So this is on the first page. Suppose I were to begin by saying that I had fallen in love with a color. Suppose I were to speak as though it were a confession. Suppose I shredded my napkin as we spoke. It began slowly, an appreciation, an affinity. Then one day it became more serious. Then, looking into an empty teacup, its bottom stained with thin brown excrement coiled in the shape of a seahorse, it became somehow personal. So this is kind of like the mission of Bluets as a whole. It's an investigation into a colour. Diwale, do you want to kick us off with your favourite passage or one of your favourite passages?
In that synopsis, as you've given it, and she explores on the colour and what it ignites in you. My favorite thing about it, not necessarily a passage because there's a few which I liked, was exploration of color and psychology. And funnily enough, while I was reading, I was walking up and down Chicago, and there's an Institute of Goethe, and she mentions Goethe, the psychologist, and his color play very much. I tried to get into that institute, but it really did spark up a few things. And when you're feeling blue, that's what ignited it for me. And the Bluets in itself just makes me think of a 60s doo-wop band. Immaculately dressed, you got your baritone, your alto, your tenor, and what's the high range singer called? The falsetto. Yeah, that harmony, and if you like those four facets of how you could explore feeling blue.
I love that. It does sound like a band, and yeah, I think for me, we can kind of go through these various fragments and pick up on various themes, and there's a lot of them. There's, in a way, there's a lot going on here, but I think you're right, it all seems to be encapsulated in that very, very simple idea of just simply feeling blue. This is a text about, is it about mental health? I'm not sure. Is it about well-being? But it is, about that phrase, kind of feeling blue as well. Deborah, I'll let you kind of have a go in a little bit, but I'm going to jump in with one of my favorite quotes. So this is on page 28 of our editions, and this is fragment number 72. It is easier, of course, to find dignity in one's solitude. Loneliness is solitude with a problem. Can blue solve the problem, or can it at least keep me company within it? No, not exactly. It cannot love me that way. It has no arms. But sometimes I do feel its presence to be a sort of wink. Here you are again, it says, and so am I. So I quite liked this because I think, and me and Diwali were sort of talking beforehand, and I see that you've highlighted this section as well. And just, is that the word brilliant by it?
Yeah.
Great.
It is.
I think what I liked about it is it seemed to encapsulate the entire project as a whole, in that we're not finding answers in the color. We're not trying to summarize the color in an academic sense, although there is certainly references, like you say, to philosophy and to science. It was more personal and bizarre and ethereal and hard to pin down like that. I just thought the whole idea of getting obsessed with a particular color was just such a lovely one. And the way that we're not glorifying it too, right? No, not exactly. It cannot love me in that way. It has no arms. The color cannot hug us back. I thought that was really kind of sincere and honest. There is just that sincerity in the voice throughout. Deborah, I'm so sorry. I'm going to go to Diwali just now because I can see on his page that that word brilliant is kind of shining out. What was it that made you highlight that?
And when you're examining your feelings, sometimes you don't necessarily want to come up with an answer. Aha, I've got it. But not necessarily understand it, but someone who's walking with you or understands it. So empathy, that's it. And I think that's why sometimes we may throw on the Don Williams CD or the Commodores or even the 60s doo-wop band just to say, yeah, you get it. And maybe it's not the first, second, or the eighth track. But that in itself, I think, as you saw, I wrote brilliant there. But that theme, I think, framed it better. But it excited me, but it lost its color. I think that the blueness got a bit washed out a little bit sometimes.
I feel as though I know what you mean. Yeah. And I think maybe we'll kind of come back to that. Deborah, did you want to kind of come in on that passage at all?
I suppose I see it rather differently. I mean, these 240, I think she refers to them as propositions, these 240 little kind of verses or chapters. And to me, the entire book is about heartbreak. And the love of blue is really a metaphor for her obsessive love for this man who is never named, except she calls him the Prince of Blue at one point. She doesn't even name him. And I sometimes, although I love the idea of being obsessive about a colour and I love that she collects all these things, I sort of wondered if it was a device that she was hiding behind and that she really ought to just be more explicit about the fact that she'd had this terrible heartbreak, that she'd fallen in love with somebody who could not love her back or would not love her back. And that's kind of how I see it. I mean, I enjoy the meditations on blue. What blue means, and that, you know, she brings in references from philosophers and other writers. I like all that. But I had a conversation with Diwali last week outside campus, and I was sort of saying that I felt she could have been more honest about what this book was really about. That's my feeling.
I like device. I think that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I felt there was shallowness in the blue in somewhat because she was trying to fill so many different jars, I think. Yes, it seemed that she was definitely emotionally into the chap, but we didn't really explore that relationship much more just her feeling blue at his absence. And then she'd go philosophically, then she'd reference her sick friend and that. So we didn't really get into the depth of the blue. And that's that was what lost me a bit. And in 240 statements. What was she on? Two a month for a year, or 20 a month for a year? I wonder how it came to that many. 240 seems like an odd and exact number to say.
It does. Yeah, it does. I think you're right in that if you pick up this book thinking that you're going to end with a lot of a new insight into the color blue, okay, you might, but it's not about that. It's not the aim. I think, like you say, Deborah, it's a love story, right? Mm. Or it's a heartbreak story at its core, definitely.
Yeah.
Deborah, do you want to come in with your favorite section?
Yes, thank you, Sam. She picks up on, Maggie Nelson picks up on something that's a particular hobby horse of mine, which is about the pathologizing of human emotion that goes on these days. And the proposition I'd like to read follows an encounter with a therapist who tries to persuade her that actually she's been in love with a man who doesn't really exist. He's not as lovely as you think he was. You know, you've been in love with a ghost because he lied to you. Well, we all lie to each other all the time, particularly in love. I mean, we could hardly stay together if we didn't. But anyway, Maggie Nelson says, "This pains me enormously. She presses me to say why. I can't answer. Instead, I say something about how clinical psychology forces everything we call love into the pathological or the delusional or the biologically explicable. That if what I was feeling wasn't love, then I'm forced to admit that I don't know what love is, or more simply, that I loved a bad man. How all of these formulations drain the blue right out of love and leave an ugly, pigmentless fish flapping on a cutting board on a kitchen counter." And I just love that image, this sort of, you know, colourless fish lying there as a symbol of her love. And I sort of feel in our living in the age of therapy as we do, that emotions and things which once found a poetic expression are now pathologized, and how it's not always helpful, you know, and how actually maybe the old kind of the old cures like music and poetry and books were better cures for lost love than therapy. But that's, you know, that could be my generation talking. I don't know. But I very much enjoyed that she picked up on that, because I think this pathologizing of emotion, it diminishes love. It demeans the love that you shared with somebody, and it reduces it to something that can be found in a textbook. And of course, all love is luminous between the two people that share it.
Something quantifiable. And I think that so much of the text is trying to get away from that, which is perhaps why we never arrive at the color blue. We never arrive at the definition of it.
No.
I really like the fact that you've brought up images, because I think this is a real strength of the piece as a whole. This is the occasional image. It's a prosaic collection. It's a lyric essay. It's fairly prosaic. There's the occasional image, like that fish, like this bottom, the bottom of the teacup stained with thin brown excrement coiled into the shape of a seahorse, which is just beautiful, really, really beautiful, and kind of attempts to get at something, which I suppose the rest of the text, if you try and articulate something so clearly, like you were kind of saying, Diwali, is impossible to get at. The image seems to be able to do that, to kind of evoke those emotions rather than any sense of kind of reason. Yeah.
Yeah. I like the fact, as you said, that the contrast of artistic expression rather than a more clinical way, of which when she's seeing her therapist about it, and sometimes you, as I said, you just want someone to accompany you, rather than just analyze it and just, well, it's this, that, here's a tablet for it, you'll be good in the morning. It's something you want to come back to try, maybe it's over time, but it, when you're with your therapist, you got an hour and a half, 2 hours or so they want to get something out of it. It's like, here you go, here's something for your prescription, and then go away. Sometimes it's just hearing again that you normalize or humanize your feelings about it, without necessarily having a prescription or a pill to make it go away. So that the way you put it, path, how did you put it? pathology, I think you put it.
Pathologically.
Pathologizing. Yeah, it's not necessarily helpful in coming to a conclusion of self-analysis, if you like. Yeah.
Well, it's reductive, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's reductive. Yeah.
I like that idea that you've just kind of said to Ali. I wonder if you've just summed up the text accidentally by saying kind of sometimes we just want company.
Yes.
Sometimes we just want something to accompany us. Mm. And it feels as though part of the mission of Bluets, if there is a mission, is to find something in writing, to find something, company, some comfort, some presence in writing and in the kind of form.
It could
as
be
a whole.
It could be art. It could be writing art, an image, or just something rather than just necessarily seeing. It's got to be something fluent rather than boxed.
Yeah.
Packaged, yeah.
And catharsis as well. There's so much catharsis here that we can kind of, I guess, accompany the author on and relate back to ourselves as well. Deborah, can I ask you
I think this is an attempt at catharsis.
It feels like it, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it feels like an attempt at catharsis. And I think does it get there? I think it does. It's never going to kind of conclude, like you say, but feels as though it has a good chance at it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah, I'm just sort of thinking of form, and this is a sort of certain speciality of yours, creative nonfiction, and the lyric essay as a whole. Can I just ask you, what is a lyric essay? How would you define it?
Well, a lyric essay is really anything that defies genre. It's usually a combination. It's an essay which is devoted to the beauty of the language. It's based on true events, like all creative nonfiction. It's based in fact, but it has a fidelity to the beauty of language. So it has this poetical sensibility which runs through it. So it can be in the form of these, propositions, as in Maggie Nelson has done. Prose poetry is arguably a lyric essay. But it's generally something which is about a real event, but which is guided by aesthetic principles in the writing.
Lovely way of putting it, yeah. And that kind of brings me on to one of my first official questions, which was very, very simply, why write this journey in this way? Why use the numbered fragments rather than a kind of straightforward essay, which would maybe have a narrative, have its kind of set out its introduction and its aims. Why write it in this 240 propositions way? And like I say, some of them are a sentence, some of them are like a page. I mean, Diwali, what do you think?
I wonder if it was a challenge to herself or it was a brief. Because no doubt the feelings are real. And just as I was saying, you don't want to put them in a box or necessarily a format. And she's touched on so many different ways in which to analyze or express her grief. But I don't know why she would have done it this way. And it, quite interestingly as well, is it why 240?
Yeah.
How many were edited out? What made the cut? What was the criteria? Was it the hardest feeling? Did she do the editing herself and said, this has got to be in? No, because I really felt this one.
Mm.
And how much got screwed up and thrown on the waste paper basket. I don't know. I've tried to write this way, give myself a brief and then work backwards. I remember there's a Dave Chappelle thing where he gives himself a punchline and he says, I'm going to make a joke towards it. maybe she gave herself a brief and then I'm going to do this way and see if I can feel that, because she touched on different ways. The relationship itself, past relationships, friendships she's had with people, other ways where she tried to analyze her own feelings through her friend. I think she had a friend who was disabled as well. And then she went to different places. And I think said she touches in different jars to try and frame, if you like, what she's trying to feel. 240 ways. It's interesting. It's an interesting way, but I can't come up with an answer, a definitive answer as to why would you do it this way.
I think you have. I like that idea of frame. The whole thing is like notes for an essay. It's like this framing of the idea and circling of the wider idea, but avoiding that conclusion. Deb, but what about you? Why write it in this way?
Well, I don't know. We'd have to ask Maggie Nelson, but my feeling is it's a container. I think she needed to arrive, find a container for a story which is very fragmented. I think this would have been very difficult to write as an essay or a novella because there are too many competing ideas. You know, there's this idea of love and lost love. There's the incident with her friend being injured. There's Meditations on Blue. She talks about her career. And I think what this provides, these 240 propositions, it provides a container. And I can imagine that she wrote each of them and then was able to move them around like puzzle pieces to get the order. That's how I see it in my head. But I think it's a really clever way to group together ideas that don't necessarily have a natural relationship with each other, that they're contained within their own little proposition. So it doesn't matter if they don't necessarily have a relationship to the idea which came before or the one that comes after. So I think it's clever the way she's done it.
It is, yeah. And I like those narrative leaps that we have to make when you go from one section to another that don't seem to have any immediate correspondence, but you make it kind of work in your mind in some way. You find some story there.
I was just going to say there are all sorts of questions that never get answered. And I think we're at an essay, we might feel shortchanged. But because they're boxed off in these little propositions, we kind of we're able to accept the ambiguity. The ambiguity feels deliberate when it's constructed in this fashion.
There's so many questions raised and there's no conclusive answers at all there. But that's the interesting thing. It leaves you there for interpretation.
Yeah.
At least room for interpretation. And that's a good thing about it. None of those jars which I mentioned or frames seem full of anything. No, but they're populated.
Yes.
But there's a suggestion or a hint of different things within those different frames or jars. Yeah. But as you say, it's a compilation, Deborah. As you said, it's a compilation. Is it? Well, this is, to use the term, I emotional condensation on this matter. Mm. That's it, and I'll put it there.
Emotional condensation, I like that. Diwali, do you want to come in with one of your questions?
That for the questions, and I think the thing was that of 240, I wonder how many didn't make the cut, and what were they that dismissive, or did she? I really would want to know how she whittled them down, and over what time period she grieves. To see, is there an abating of the feeling? And as you said, Deborah, how she changes, possibly changed around the order. It was something she might have written first and then joined it with something she wrote later and then came back to it to evolve a thought or a feeling. Those are the questions there. It is interesting because it didn't say day one, day two. It's not a journal or day three or anything like that. It is, I believe she probably wrote these things and then changed around the order for just say, well, this will go with this or go with that. But that said, sometimes one will be on something on philosophical interpretation. Then she just goes off to the color itself.
Yeah.
And then talking about the color spectrum and what its color opposite. I remember there's a time where she said blue is opposite orange, purple is opposite white. And it's, whoa, let me explore that. And then you come back. So it is interesting how and what time period she captured these thoughts over.
I think that's a really worthy question from a creative writing point of view, and because the whole text feels quite organic, feels quite easy in a way that it's just notes that have been put down,
not constrained
and not overly kind of crafted. But of course it is in any piece of creative writing, and particularly a radical piece of writing. Is crafted, is edited, is kind of cut down, as you say. So I think that's a really, really good point to make, is that there was some curation that happened here in order to kind of funnel a story. And you mentioned grief as well, which I'm glad you have, because I know Deborah mentioned it earlier. And this is, I guess, above all things, a story of grief and physical longing as well. And I wonder if there's something in the fragmentation, something in the form, which speaks to that, because it's a theme which comes back and back. And like you say, we have some discussion of the color spectrum. Then we will have some kind of explicit sexual content. So this is the text out of all the ones in the Radical Writing podcast which has the most explicit sexual content in it. And I was quite struck by that. It's easy to kind of be shocked by that when it kind of happens, when you're reading about the color blue and all of a sudden you're kind of encountering a very, very different passage. So I thought that was quite interesting, that connection between grief and sex, and grief and kind of physical longing, because I don't know how many other texts would have tackled that subject in the same way.
Well, I think that idea isn't new. I think that in grief people turn to sex because it's a way of feeling alive. It's a counterpoint to death, if you like. But my feeling about the sex in this book was that it was a bit gratuitous, I felt, and jarring in places. And I wondered why she'd done it. It was almost like, it was obviously a very passionate affair, love affair they had, you know, and that's great. And it's not that I object to reading sexually explicit material, but I wondered if she was hiding behind that, because what she really wanted to say is, I love him, I love him, I love him, I love him, I love him. But that sort of wasn't cool. So it was easier to talk about the sex instead. I don't know. I sort of almost felt the sex was a displacement from what she really felt, this intense passion and love for this man. That's just my reading of it. And I think that's why I found the sex quite jarring, because the rest of it was so sort of poetic. And very human, very, very human. And she, I like the way she leaves gaps in the writing for the reader to insert their own experience. It's like we get these pauses, these breathing spaces between the propositions where we can reflect on similar experiences of our own. But yes, that was my feeling.
And I can see that Diwali is definitely kind of agreeing with you there. And yeah, I think I would sort of put out, is it a distraction or is it a device? Is it just that device to kind of show that feeling? But at the same time, I do kind of agree with you. I was sort of in two minds about some of that content. It is jarring. It is, yeah. It is kind of out there. But I guess that was sort of the point. I'm gonna kind of move on, I think, to my question, because Deborah, you've kind of wonderfully introduced it, which is that it does invite you. This text is quite inviting into your own sense of catharsis, your own sense of reflection. So what I want to ask you is, what is your favorite color and what would searching for it look like to you? Deborah, take it away.
I mean, I do love the color blue. I'm very drawn to it, but then I love water. It represents water to me. It represents weightlessness and obviously the sky. I love that. I find it a deeply inviting color, very attractive color. And what was the second part of the question? Sorry, Sam.
What would sort of searching for it mean to you? What form would that take, do you think?
For me, I suspect I would visit lots of different watering holes, rivers and lakes and seas. And yes, I think I would do that.
Similarly to you, and apparently 65% of the world's population, blue is my favorite color, very much so is. And water definitely was where I'd start my search to get that aquamarine, real bluey, green, turquoisey feel before the coral reefs all whiten and bleach, of course, and be down there looking for Nemo and experience that. But me and Jacques Cousteau would be down there just living the life. I love the color blue. I like, as you said, it's nature, sky and water, if you like. It bookends what we see. That's great. And not just the blue, but the blue does represent water for me, and that's peaceful, it's calming. And it wasn't until over the last 5 years, actually, I've realized how much being around water. Water definitely helps me with that. And but the blues or the bluettes, that's musical. It is not the duets. It's definitely a doo-wop band in some nicely tailored tight suits, maybe a little short on the ankles, But yeah,
blue suits,
blue, not necessary. It could be gray, but something would be there. Yeah, with women throwing roses on the stage and tight steps. Yeah, that's the blues. But blue is my favorite color, and now I'm arcing back to feeling like a Chelsea fan.
Yeah.
From a song from the 70s. But
I think I'm going to bring us back to land, but actually for the same reasons. And I'm going to go for an orange. Used to be red. It is the opposite color, right? It used to kind of be red, but maybe I'm kind of softening. I think there's something just pastoral about an orange sky, a harvest moon. I'm just kind of getting this image of wheat fields and things like that. A little bit of a cliche, but it's a comforting cliche.
It is nice. If you see autumn leaves next to blue water, it's spectacular.
I think the second half of that question is harder to answer. So what would your form of discovery take? Do you know, Diwale? How would you discover the color blue in a new way?
Wow. Hopefully I don't incur the blues higher than I've had before. Yes. Like Maggie Nelson, I've had my broken hearts and what have you. But I attempted to capture it in my interpretation on the poem I wrote, if you like.
Well, hey, let's go for that now. Yeah, Diwale, take it away.
Okay, so the bluettes. And it is, as I've said before, it's pretty much a framing a doo-wop band and their interpretation of broken hearts and what have you.
So this is a first for the podcast as well, a creative response to the text.
The bluettes, never the headliners, but always relate as the definers of what becomes of the brokenhearted. Four-man doo-wop depicting through tight harmonies the pain, harm, and agonies of love lost and its cost. Love's found and lost revealing the best untold stories captured on an album compilation, preferably vinyl. Let the needle drop. Classic doo-wop, as good as it gets. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the bluettes. The bluettes, ladies and gentlemen, please. Straight to it, tenor leads, he pleads, synchronized with his fellow baritone, alto, and falsetto singers, bringers of empathy, joy, and sadness. Anyone who had a heart would call a carpenter to behold this a cappella carving, crafting that Bacharach may well have written or not, with lyrical dexterity comparable to complex origami, unfolding stories by the dozens, rude signals missed, the passionate kiss, the bliss, the regrets. Behold, I give you the duets. Big on empathy, critically diffusing the emotional condensation, examination with a lyrical hook, moving through 8 3-minute tracks back to back to leave you feeling for better or worse. Each verse prompts a self-examination, extended play written by personal anecdotes that you wrote or wish you had as you reference the chronicles of personal timelines, wishing that once upon a next time you'll rewrite a line that helps you define regrets and mistakes that you made. Let the ad libs be played through to fade.
Brilliant. Well done, Diwale.
Natural darker shades of the blue.
Thank you. Expect to hear that at our next open mic as well. Okay, so we are sort of coming to the end of our episode. And apologies to kind of leave it on a little bit of a kind of cliffhanger there, but maybe that is appropriate for the novel as a whole, that we've kind of lacked an eloquent conclusion to it.
Yes.
So the 2017 edition of Bluettes is easy to find, and you can pick up a copy of Maggie Nelson's Bluettes online or through your local bookshop or library. This hardback edition is also surprisingly affordable, and there are also many secondhand copies available. You can read an excerpt on the Pen America website too. Diwale, Deborah, thank you so, so much for coming on, and thank you so much for your attention on this particular text. I now get to present Diwale to you in person, and Deborah, I will give this to you next time I see you, your radical writing flag. So congratulations.
Thank you.
How exciting.
I love this.
Finally,
the first time I've been described as a radical writer.
There you go.
Exactly. I've always been described as a radical writer, actually. That's what
there you go. Finally, I did kind of want to ask Diwale as well, are you working on anything at the moment? Because I feel as though I bumped into you a few times and there's something in the works. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. I'm working on another compilation called Overdue. Due spelled D-E-W, which is the first three letters of my name. And it's just stuff which I've had compiled or working on for a while, trying to find the headspace to do myself justice in writing and presenting as well. I want to get back into writing more. I love the creative facet of it, the expression, the social observation, but it's overdue because I've been sitting on it for a while.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hopefully Maggie Nelson's Bluets has helped.
Yeah, but thank you for inviting me into it, actually. It sparks a lot of things, making space to be creative and assess and critique myself in my creative process. And it is a nice way of going looking at things and compiling.
Brilliant. Diwali Deborah, thank you so much for coming on. You have been listening to the Radical Writing Podcast. A huge thank you to my guests, Deborah Walker and Diwali Dimeji. And an equally huge thank you to our production team, Alistair Robinson, Mark Dutton, and Rob Adey. Join us next time for episode 7, where we'll be discussing M. Nabulsi Phillips' Zong. And as always, stay radical.